I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's been 10 days now since the earthquake and tsunamis swept millions of Asians from their homes. And the very same thing that caused the initial destruction now threatens to kill thousands more. We're talking about water, not the great surge of seawater that destroyed the villages. It's the search for clean, drinkable water that now separates people from survival and death. This hour, in the third part of our series, Innovation That Matters, we'll talk with an environmental physicist whose expertise is all about the search for drinkable water. Ashok Gadgil's work with ultraviolet light purification is now in use around the world, making clean water available to people for about 3 cents a week. So this hour, we continue to examine the relationship between technology and the needs of people. And we ask now that we can do anything, what will we do? We'll talk about the struggle to make water available to the millions who have none, and also ask who's responsible for paying for the resource. Is fresh water, as some have said, a human right, something governments are obliged to provide? Or is it a commodity, like fuel, something that people, even the poorest among us, ought to pay for? We'll talk with Ashok Gadgil in just a moment. First, though, we're going to hear from Ali Khan Rajani. He is spokesman for the relief organization CARE. He joined us on the line from Banda Aceh in Indonesia. I asked him to give us an estimate of how many people there are at risk because they can't get clean water.
I can tell you that there are approximately 200,000 internally displaced people, and they are scattered over 175 different settlements that we know of so far in Aceh. The camps, if I can give you a sense and paint a picture of what's going on, there's one camp that has 4,000 people in it. It's better to call it a settlement, I suppose, because it's not a formal camp. But that one settlement has only one water point for 4,000 people and 8 toilets. So you can just imagine the access to water is so minimal, and the access to sanitation and toilets is so minimal. Now, of course, it's so hot outside. There's still dead bodies everywhere. So as a result, that the water is contaminated, especially in the urban areas. And then people end up, for simple survival, end up drinking that water. And, of course, that leads to waterborne diseases like cholera, dysentery, typhoid, and so on.
Ali Khan, what's your best strategy? Is it to try and distribute those chlorinated water kits that CARE was getting out in the early days, or is it really to just try and get pallets of bottled water into these camps and settlements?
We're finding that the best strategy for us that we can deliver most efficiently and effectively would be the water purification systems, because those bottles would actually last people a month. We are actually taking the precaution and saying that a bottle would last them 2 weeks. That way, they're doubling up on it, and they're better to be safe than sorry as far as we're concerned. Versus bottled water is, first of all, difficult to fly in. I was in Banda Aceh Airport early this morning trying to get in. Our flight was delayed by 14 hours, and when our flight did get in, the amount of cargo coming out and just the volume of the aid coming in is something that is barely manageable because the airport is not equipped for it. Not to mention it's expensive to fly in these things, and logistically becomes difficult to bring in bottled water. So it's much easier, we find, to be doing it through the chlorination system. In fact, the chlorination system is something that CARE Indonesia has been working on for a long time in Indonesia and has been very effective. So we are using a local manufacturer to produce the product, and it's much easier to distribute it and will last them a lot longer and hopefully save lives of these people who need water for basic survival every single day.
Ali Khan, I know how busy you are, so I want to thank you for taking a few moments to talk with us.
You're very welcome.
Ali Khan Rajani is CARE spokesman, talking to us there from Banda Aceh in Indonesia. Let's meet our guest for the hour. Ashok Gadgil, as I mentioned earlier in the program, is an environmental physicist, senior staff scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Library at the University of California, Berkeley, has a number of patents and inventions to his credit, chief among them UV Waterworks, a technology that uses ultraviolet light to inexpensively disinfect drinking water in developing countries. And he's joining us from a studio at Berkeley. Ashok, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
You're the water expert. Tell me how you're regarding the situation as we see it unfolding for the people in the zones hit by the tsunami, what you're hearing from Ali Khan.
In addition to what I just heard from Ali Khan, BBC gave the numbers yesterday of about 5 million homeless people who are all displaced and living in camps without water points or with minimal water points, with minimal sanitation facilities. So we are looking at a potential for a huge or comparably large loss of life to the people who died directly as a result of the tsunamis. So we are looking at about, you know, potential losses of lives of on the order of 100,000.
Still beyond the 150,000 that have been reported so far.
That is right. And that's the potential for losses of life arising from poorly controlled epidemics, primarily of diarrheal diseases, cholera, typhoid, and so on.
We're going to talk about
waterborne diseases.
Yeah, we'll talk about the work that you do in just half a moment, but a word from you perhaps just on the kits that CARE is handing out, because what they're doing is handing out a means of chlorinating the water in a situation like that, which nobody could have predicted, and even in towns that might have had clean water and today have none. Is that the best they can do?
Well, not necessarily. It all depends on the logistical support that one can get. A chlorination system requires support and maintenance of a steady supply chain of chlorine to the particular unit that chlorinates the water. On the other hand, if you have nothing else, I would certainly rely on chlorination as a life-saving device and not worry at all about any of the byproducts of chlorination, which have a slight amount of carcinogenic properties, but that's such a minor threat compared to the threat of diarrheal disease and death that certainly the byproducts of chlorination are not a worry. The worry is, can one maintain for in the long run a supply chain of chlorine? Because the amount of chlorine that is to be added to the water depends upon the turbidity of the water, amount of organic material that can be a sink for chlorine and will thus potentially protect the pathogens. Also,
you mean the more guck that's in the water, the more chlorine you have to put in it?
Exactly right, Dick. And not only that, eventually a point will come when you have to put in so much chlorine that water becomes unpotable from the amount of chlorine you put in. So you have to do something else than chlorine. But so there is no single perfect solution. However, chlorination is one solution. And Ali Khan is absolutely right in saying that shipping bottled water puts such a huge strain on logistical resources. Just the mass of water coming in and out takes up so much space and manpower that it's much smarter to try to disinfect water on site than shipping it all over the place.
Ashok, you were raised in Bombay, now Mumbai, on the west coast of India. What was the water situation that you grew up with? I'm just curious to know if your professional interest in it actually began with your own personal interest in clean water.
Fortunately, when I was growing up, and even now, the old parts of the city of Bombay receive pressurized, chlorinated water supply. However, my relatives who were in the countryside were not so fortunate, and I lost a few cousins. I was a child then, so I didn't quite understand the significance of what was going on. But a few cousins died as a result of waterborne diarrheal diseases when I was a child. And the situation has very slowly but definitely improved in Indian countryside with a massive implementation of a tube well program pushed by the Indian government.
Tube wells are the wells that take water from a pure source fairly deep in the ground?
That's right. They could be either deep or shallow, but almost all Indian tube wells are deep and they take water from the ground. And there is a hand pump on the top of the tube well. So you have a bore, and then there is a hand pump that allows people to walk up to it, pump the water out. And there is a worker who has actually come and educated the people about the importance of drinking clean water as a way to maintain their health and avoid diarrheal disease.
You know, Ashok, you and I have grown up understanding the importance of clean water and the dangers of the bacteria that's in the water. But if you think back to those cousins of yours who were killed by waterborne diseases, are we to think or to realize perhaps that this understanding of the importance of water that is very clean is actually quite new?
That's absolutely right. In many, many parts of the world, even today, the source or the cause of diarrheal diseases, even waterborne diarrheal diseases, is not commonly attributed to pathogens in the drinking water. Just 10 days ago, I was in deep kind of forested parts of India in a tribal village where the standard understanding of the tribals is that diarrheal diseases are caused owing to some evil eye cast on them by somebody else. And the standard treatment is to go to the local, what has to be translated as the spiritual doctor or the witch doctor.
And are you able to persuade those people that a glass of clean water might make a difference?
The trouble is, Dick, there are two reasons. One is I was just visiting,
yeah.
And to persuade somebody, you need to be accepted as a reliable source of information whom they can trust, and you have to be with them for some time. I was not in that position. On the other hand, a single glass of clean water is not like medicine. They have to understand that water, while it can be a source of pathogens, clean water is not going to protect them if they do something dangerous like not drink safe water just for 2 days.
I need to stop you right there just because we're going to take a short break. One thing that Ashok Gadgil does is provide that kind of clean water to people all around the world. And we're interested in hearing from you, Connection listeners, whether or not you see that as a right or a commodity, something people ought to pay for. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection in our ongoing series, Innovation That Mattered. My guest this hour is Ashok Gadgil. He's joining us from a studio in Berkeley, California, where he works as a senior staff scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. And Ashok, we should talk about UV Waterworks. This is your technology, the one that you invented to inexpensively disinfect drinking water. And I have to ask you if there's a sort of dummy's guide to ultraviolet light disinfection of water. Is there a way of describing how it works that even I'm going to be able to understand?
Oh, it's very straightforward, I think. We know for the whole of past 100 years or so that ultraviolet light has properties that will kill bacteria.
That's just sunlight would do that then.
Sunlight has some, to some degree, properties to do it, but the kind of ultraviolet light that destroys pathogens or bacteria is absent in sunlight because all of those wavelengths are fully absorbed by the ozone layer in the stratosphere. So by the time sunlight reaches the Earth's surface, we don't have any of the wavelengths that are so effectively destructive of the DNA. So we need to make them in the with our technology, and the technology is also very straightforward. You essentially have the technology in every kitchen fluorescent tube light.
Mm-hmm.
Effectively, a fluorescent tube light operates just by making exactly the ultraviolet light of the correct wavelength to destroy DNA, though that's not the intent in this case. So you take a tube light and remove the phosphor lining, which is on the inside of the glass tube.
The sort of frosted lining, glass. Yeah, okay.
Phosphor is the thing that converts UV light into visible light.
Right.
Right. And instead of a glass tube, one uses a quartz tube so that the UV light can get out. And that's it. You have a source of very efficient ultraviolet light of the correct wavelength, which will extremely effectively destroy DNA of all the cells and viruses on which it falls.
Does it stop the bacteria then from reproducing, or does it actually kill the bacteria that's in the water?
It apparently does both. If you damage the DNA of a single cell in a huge number of places with a lot of UV light, then the cell is unable to read the DNA even to make proteins, even to make enzymes, and then the cell itself dies as well. But for sure, even well before that happens, if the cell tries to reproduce, it will die because the DNA cannot be replicated.
Now, you have these water purification systems in place around the world. Why don't you just give us a picture of one? Mexico, for example. How is it a big tank of water that's blasted with a big light? How does it work?
The device itself is very small. It's about the size of a large microwave oven in a household appliance, kind of microwave oven. There is a lamp of producing ultraviolet light that is suspended in air. And above the lamp is a polished aluminum reflector. And below the lamp is a stainless steel trough through which water flows under the lamp at the speed just about enough to get plentiful of overdose of UV light, so that if there is any other glitch, such as water turns out to be a little more turbid than we anticipated, or the voltage has a sag, which often happens in the developing countries, any of these little glitches will not harm the or will not hurt the performance of this device. So all you have is effectively a stainless steel trough, above it suspended in air an ultraviolet lamp, and above the lamp a reflector. That's the core part of the device. And it's just the size of a microwave oven, as I said.
Is it expensive?
Pretty simple. The device alone would sell for something like, I believe, $1,500. And that's only because of low volume production currently. Right. There is a small company that has a license from the university to manufacture it, Water Health International. But the trouble there is small production leads to higher unit costs, which is simple economics, and that's what we are looking at.
I guess I'm trying to understand here whether or not it's the sort of thing that, I mean, at $1,500, you would think that any small village could arrange to have that kind of system put in place to clean the water. Is it a lack of understanding that this can work? Is it a lack of promote? What is it that this isn't being used more widely?
Very good question. Actually, there are two or three different causes. One is this entire issue of split incentives. In some places like Mexico and throughout Latin America, the societies expect the government to provide safe drinking water. And the folks in the government who have the authority to push such programs commonly are not the ones exposed to living in rural conditions with completely unsafe water. They drink bottled water, and they live in cities, and they have fixed salaries, and they are doing reasonably all right compared to people who are living on the brink. So that's one part of the problem. The other problem is this device alone is not enough. When we field tested it in India and South Africa and in Mexico, the feedback we got from the villagers was they don't want to have a device sitting there by itself without any pumping or without any pre-filtering, which they want an integrated solution. They do not want a technology. They want a solution. And if they want a solution, I need to worry about how to put together my disinfector with a pump and with a filter and a storage tank for the device, so with the disinfected water, so that they can have water just as they walk up to the system, whether there is electricity available or not at that particular point in time. And all of that, of course, raises the cost of the system, but nevertheless, that's what they wanted, and that's what they accepted. There are about 50 systems of that kind in the state of Guerrero in Mexico, and there are about, between 50 and 100 systems like this operating commercially in and around Manila in the Philippines, and then the few systems scattered throughout the developing countries.
Does that mean that there is a difference? You say that they're operating commercially in the Philippines, and yet people in Latin America have an expectation that government's going to provide this water for them. Is there a division there between people who regard it as a right and people who regard it as a commodity?
Absolutely right. The most of the folks in Latin America will want the drinking water to be supplied to them as a right, whereas in Asia and Africa, the question is wide open. There is generally an acceptance of hardship and a low expectation of the government in terms of supplying people with safe drinking water as an obligation. So commercial, small commercial establishments that sell safe drinking water have sprung up all over Manila, and they sell water at a price that's less than that of the bottled water, using UV water disinfection, for example, and people don't complain about it.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour is Ashok Gadgil. He is a scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory at the University of California and is the man behind UV Waterworks. It is a system of using ultraviolet light to disinfect water to make it clean and safe for people to drink. And we're talking this hour about whether or not that is something that people have a right to expect or something that they ought to pay for. We'd like to hear from you. We're going to take our first call from East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Paul's on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the call. At the other end of the pipe, East Greenwich has a sewage disposal system that does away with chlorine completely and discharges all of its water into Narragansett Bay, Greenwich Cove, which is a high-quality water body for shellfishing. So it is able to be done on a very large scale.
Sorry, you're saying that UV is used before the water is discharged?
Yes.
And
this is coming out of the sewage treatment plant, which is, you know, highly
toxic stuff. High
levels of bacteria, et cetera.
How clean is that water?
It exceeds EPA standards because it is discharging into a clean body of water. Fishable, swimmable. It's been recognized by the EPA and has won environmental awards.
So, Ashok, instead of the water coming out of the tap past the UV light, here it is going, you know, from the toilet into the, into the ocean or into the rivers after passing
the treatment plant. It goes through. It eliminates the use of chlorine. They
right.
still have the standard process
filtration
and filtrations, et cetera. But instead of it eliminates the chlorine, which adds a problem to which was mentioned earlier on, where you use too much chlorine, then you generate other problems that have to be amended.
I'm interested in hearing from Ashok whether or not this system of using it in the other end of is also being used in other places around the world.
Absolutely right. There is this. High volume treatment of tertiary or the final output from sewage treatment plants with intense ultraviolet light that kills off pathogens in that water, so that such treated UV treated water from sewage plants can be now discharged directly into public bodies of water, which are being used for both recreation and fishing and so on. So this is exactly right. In fact, 10 years ago, when I started working on UV disinfection of drinking water for the developing countries, my design goal, and that was finally met, the design goal was to be able to treat effluent from an average American wastewater, municipal wastewater or sewage treatment plant, and then produce drinking water from such effluent. Because I took that as a typical metric of how bad the water in the developing countries is. And if we can treat the effluent from municipal water in the United States and make it potable, then certainly this is something we can suggest for use in the developing world for drinking water treatment for whatever source they are currently using.
Paul, are you still there? Yeah, let me ask you what your thoughts are about whether or not, you know, you think drinking water itself is a commodity that the government has an obligation to provide, or whether or not it ought to be, a right, and or whether or not it ought to be a commodity, something that's sold.
Oh, it's an absolute right of people. You cannot allow water or water supply companies and systems to become a commodity. At that point, they control everything. Water is the baseline for all humanity and all levels of society. And once it becomes a commodity, and there are international companies right now out of France, there are three major companies that control huge systems of water, even in the United States. And that is a very scary option that all our water supplies could be run by independent companies. And now that they're going international, that raises a whole other specter. Water is a right for people, for animals, for all life to exist, and it cannot be turned into a commodity.
Ashok, I suspect you might disagree, at least in part, with what Paul's saying.
The only reason I would disagree with Paul's statement about it being a right is that in practice, if you make it a right, then the developing countries effectively say no private enterprise will come in to solve the problem, and the governments haven't solved a problem. So effectively, you are leaving the populations who need safe drinking water without either help from their own governments, because the governments are unable to deliver, and the governments will block private companies from going and solving the problem for a price.
Okay, so but let me just interrupt you here for half a sec, because you said earlier that the Mexican government, the Mexican state government in Guerrero, has installed a number of these. Isn't that evidence that the government can, in fact, take charge and provide the water free of charge?
Absolutely. It just a question of political will and financial ability to do so. While the Mexican government provided 50 units of water disinfection in 1999, for the last 4 years, there have been no additional units installed. And in the units that they did provide in 1999 have slowly declined in terms of their maintenance, only because there was not enough attention being paid. Everything was being delivered free. There was no feedback from the customers that, hey, it doesn't work, I'm paying for it, make it work.
So what you're saying is that even with water, if you place no value on it, then the consumers also place no value on its quality?
They either place no value on its quality or they do not have a handle to get back to those who are, quote-unquote, bestowing on them the benefits of safe water. In other words, if your democratic institutions are not strong enough, if your democratic feedback loop is not strong enough that people are demanding clean water, then there is no way these people are going to be able to go and say, you know, give us the water that we demand as our right.
Well, let me just ask you to explain the other side of it, because you said that this is being done privately. Water is supplied as a commodity in the Philippines. Is the distribution system better? Is the quality better? Is the growth and the interest in making this more widespread better in the Philippines?
Sure. I mean, specifically in the city of Manila, I mean, the city has a piped pressurized water distribution system that is supplied or that is maintained by the government. But that side of the operation of the system is so unreliable, both in terms of quality of water and its availability, that people who can afford to do so drink bottled water. And that's the case almost throughout all the metropolitan developing world cities. Okay, people who can afford to drink bottled water because the official supply of water is unreliable in quality. And in Manila, what has happened is, in addition to this uncertain quality of water coming out of the government network of pipes, you have stores which, much like Starbucks, you have little stores which deliver not coffee, but water. And it's not a high, you know, falutin kind of fancy store where you taste 20 different flavors of water. It's just standard water that you buy at a price much lower than the price of bottled water.
And even the slum dwellers then can afford that price?
Exactly right. Slum dwellers can afford the price because slum dwellers cannot afford the cost of fuel needed to boil their daily water. The only option available to slum dwellers is boil the water or just drink and risk the lives of themselves and their children.
My guest this hour is Ashok Gadgil. We're talking about his experience in providing clean drinking water for people right around the world. And we're interested in hearing from you about whether or not you see this as some kind of fundamental human right. That's certainly a point of view that was widely held years ago. And interested in hearing from you whether or not you see that changing. Is water becoming a commodity, whether we like that idea or not? 1-800-423-TALK. That's the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection in this series, Innovation That Matters. We're probing the relationship between technology and the needs of the world this hour, talking specifically about the work to make water available to the millions of people in the world who do not have access to clean water. The estimates are that 20% up to 30% of the people in the world are at risk from dirty water. We're also talking about who's responsible for paying for the resource. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Ashok Gadgil is with us. He has won a number of environmental and scientific awards for his invention, UV Waterworks, a technology which inexpensively uses ultraviolet light to disinfect drinking water. We're going to take our next call from Boston, Massachusetts, and Sandra's with us. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling. What are your thoughts this morning?
Well, I practically catch the presentation in the middle because I just came back from work, but I was interested to clarify a little bit or get some clarification the access of fresh water and safe drinking water, because I am originally from Mexico, and I know that people have been no longer believe that the water is safe to drink as long as it's coming from the tap. So the people is really buying bottled water in order to have some security, even though there have been a couple of scandals because some companies don't quite filter or use the more adequate technology to provide a safe water.
Is that even poor people in Mexico City are buying bottled water?
Yes, and actually you can buy those for you buy from a water depot that now are very popular in Mexico City. You can buy a bottle for 10 pesos, which is about a dollar for like a gallon of water, versus when you buy it in your house, it's almost triple the price. But then we are talking about small and very poor communities that have to afford, because they cannot buy much. The gas is more expensive than buy the bottled water.
So it's cheaper to buy that than it is to boil the water.
Yes.
That's number one. Number two, these systems that are available on the market, of home UV systems or the filtering using those ceramic candles, are these things that people use or not?
I have not seen them. Probably they are in very remote or very small projects that are not well spread.
Ashok, talk with Sandra here about the difference between what you know can be done and what she experiences in Mexico City. I mean, we're talking in this case about a very, very large city.
Sure. Hi, Sandra.
Hi.
The situation you describe is common throughout the large cities in the developing countries. The water coming out of the tap is actually not reliable, and often it is contaminated because the water pipes are broken in places, and groundwater, which is already laced with raw sewage, enters the water pipes when the pressure of the water is low or negative. And then when the pressure becomes positive again, you effectively get contaminated, fecal-tainted water delivered to your home by the municipal tap. $1 a gallon is a huge, huge burden on the people that you describe have to purchase the water from the stores. However, one can actually disinfect water and treat it at a far lower price. Dick earlier quoted the right number, that you can actually provide 10 liters or 2.5 gallons of safe water per person per day for a price of about 3 cents a week. And that includes the cost of all capital and supplies and equipment and consumables, but does not include cost of course, sales and marketing and advertising and having somebody deliver the water to your home or to the store. But the core cost of disinfection is so low that you can actually make affordable water available to large number of people as a private enterprise and make that without really putting a burden on their finances.
I wonder, Ashok, in your own experience talking about this in different parts of the world, if people look at the system that you're offering and see a light and see the aluminum reflector and the trough that you describe and go, this is snake oil. This is magic. This isn't going to clean my water.
We had the system tested in 11 different independent labs in 5 different countries using water laced with pathogens taken from diarrheal disease patients in hospitals, you know, clinical
right.
isolates of cholera and typhoid and shigella, blood dysentery, this, that, and other. And every time the results came up shining.
You misunderstand my question. I'm not raising that question about it. But what I'm wondering is when you take it to a place where
right.
the only kind of treatment that has happened is straining the water or boiling the water, I wonder if there is a resistance to it because it seems so different from what people might otherwise have known.
Oh, sorry, I misunderstood. You're exactly right. The folks in the Philippines, when they sell this water through their water stores, have, of course, developed the show of the water store to make it look very hygienic. People wear white coats in the store before they, you know, as they approach the customer. There is a lot of glass and ceramic and stainless steel
right.
in the decor of the store to provide the cultural impression of hygienic conditions, even though that cultural impression is not related to the water treatment. That's in the background. But other than that, there has been no resistance in terms of people saying, well, it can't work so well. Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
All right.
Never seen it.
Let's hear from Scott, who's joining us now from Ludlow, Vermont. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Two things. First of all, a comment. I think water is a right, along with food and health care. But in a system that doesn't have any economic incentive to conserve water, it will be misused, and we charge for water in most communities here in the United States. So I think ultimately we have to put in place safety mechanisms to ensure that people who, through bad luck or bad decisions or living in a poor community, can't afford the water, have some access to it.
Mm-hmm.
But there also needs to be some cost and incentive to help people manage the resource and use it cleverly. Secondly, I was in a small town in Nicaragua where, as a sister city relationship, we were building a library. And they had a very simple water distribution system where they used chlorine to chlorinate the water, chlorine being in the form of essentially laundry bleach, which is a very inexpensive chemical. And I'm wondering about the operating cost of these electric devices versus simple chlorination type systems.
Ashok?
Good question, Scott. First of all, I completely agree with your point that water, if it is made available, it should be a right, but on the other hand, it's much like food. In spite of food being a basic right, we do not make food available free of cost, even at a lifeline rate. Well, in the industrial countries, we do to those who are in hardships. But if you went to developing countries, even though we consider food to be a right, we do not make food available free of cost. There's got to be some way in which it is not wasted. So one can think of lifeline rates or some kind of mechanism to do that. Coming to the chlorination question, chlorine is a very effective and inexpensive way to disinfect water if it is done on a large scale. If one is disinfecting water for 100,000 people, it's really, really inexpensive to disinfect that water with chlorine. The moment you go to a small-scale system, when the number of people for whom you are disinfecting drops to just 1,000 or 2 or a few hundred, then the cost of chlorination really goes through the roof. Fortunately, that does not happen with ultraviolet disinfection. You can scale the system to small size, and the prices drop almost proportionally. So a 60-watt electricity consumption, which is what UV Waterworks has, which is like a table lamp worth of electricity, disinfects enough drinking water for 2,000 people.
But,
so that gives you...
In a village of 1,000 or 2,000 people in the developing world, if the electricity is interrupted, does that mean then that their supply of water is interrupted?
Good question, Dick. No, it doesn't have to be interrupted because you don't store the electricity, you store the water.
Uh-huh.
So if you have intermittent electricity, you disinfect water when the electricity is available, and then you store the water so that the water is available all the time. And if you don't have, of course, grid-connected electricity, you can run this whole thing on a photovoltaic or some kind of renewable system. We have all our test sites in South Africa running on photovoltaic systems just fine.
We're going to take another call from Spokane, Washington. Larry's joining us on the line. Hi, Larry.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Well, Scott stole some of my thunder, and that my part of my point was is that water is in reality a commodity, so to ask is it a right is kind of misleading. There is a cost in providing water. One of the differences is, though, that here in Spokane and everywhere I lived in the United States, it's a government monopoly that that sells me the water. What your guest is proposing is a more of a free enterprise of competition, that if somebody else can come in and sell the water cheaper, they can do that. And that's a benefit to the people rather than our current system of it's I pay what the tax rate is, and I have very little say in establishing that rate.
Larry, do you have any idea what you pay for water in a given year in Spokane?
Yes, it's in the neighborhood of $1,200-$1,300.
And that's regardless of how much you use, or that is keyed to how much you use?
That's keyed to how much I use. But even in our area, it varies. When I lived out towards Newman Lake, which is a suburb, much more rural, I paid $150 a year for unlimited water. When we moved into town, now I pay on a per-gallon basis, and with typical use, we pay $1,200, $1,300 a year.
Ashok, tell me in your view whether or not that's more than the 3 cents a week that we were talking about. Is that because it's a monopoly system? Does this play into what you were saying earlier about the idea that maybe as a commodity with competition, it could be better for people even in the United States?
Oh, well, we are comparing apples and oranges here, Dick. I was talking about just drinking water, and Larry is referring to his standard water supply for the entire household use, including the dishwasher and
right.
a clothes washer and so on.
Yeah, I hadn't
so, yeah, so the difference is enormous. It's like we are talking about 10 liters per person per day for drinking water, and we are in, so 2.5 gallons per person per day. Whereas in the U.S., the average person uses 250 gallons of water per day, and that's the difference here. Secondly, when I say private enterprise can provide drinking water, I'm not thinking of a monopoly. I'm thinking of solving the problem on the ground in back of beyond countries in the developing world where the governments do not have the ability or the political will or the financial muscle to do what it takes to provide drinking water. If you allow private sector to come in and sell water competitively, just the drinking water, mm-hmm. competitively for a profitable margin, by competition, the prices will come down, but the damn thing will be available. Currently, nobody goes there and nothing is available, and people are dying at a rate of about 400 deaths per hour from diarrheal diseases, which are waterborne, throughout the developing world.
And what do you see ahead? I mean, There's two ways of looking at this. One is what can be done or what ought to be done and what is being done for those people in regions where so many people are dying because of the diseases that you're talking about. And then we had a caller earlier in the program, Ashok, talking about the danger that water is going to be a commodity and something that even industrialized nations will fight over. Do you see these two things coming together, or are they completely separate issues?
I believe they are completely separate issues only because the kind of commodity wars that we are referring to talk of entire city supply being a monopoly with a single multinational corporation coming in and then squeezing the residents for what they consider to be fair rates, but which sometimes are exorbitant rates from the perspective of the city residents. That's the kind of entire cities being taken over situation. On the other end, I'm talking about just drinking water being made available, and the people in these very, very poor communities continuing to use water of highly uncertain quality for, say, washing their clothes. so that they are not, in some sense, suddenly being held hostage by saying, hey, you know, all of your water is now going to be priced at this rate, and you have the choice of either dying of thirst or paying me what I asked for. So that is not what I'm thinking of.
How much of this is tied up with class, though? I mean, when you describe the situation of being able to live in a part of Bombay where there was pressurized and chlorinated water available, I mean, you know how many people in that city and in the surrounding slums have no access to any clean water at all. But as long as you have the political class consuming water that is somehow potable or at least affordable, how long will the people in the countryside continue to live with the risks that you're describing?
You put your finger on it, Dick. There is this disconnect between the World Bank loans going to provide safe, pressurized supply of plentiful water to the homes of the political elite exclusively, and the folks in the rural or slums being just left as they are for decades and decades.
I mean, it hasn't really changed that much in the last 20 years, has it?
There is slow progress, and you see that documented both by the World Bank and UNICEF in their assessments of how many people are being left without access to drinking water. But that number is pretty huge. Currently, 1.2 billion people don't have drinking water. And if the goals are met of having the percentage of people that don't have that access by, I believe, 2020, we still will have 800 million people without access to safe drinking water.
Ashok Gadgil is a senior staff scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory at the University of California in Berkeley. If you'd like to know more about the work that he's doing with his own inventions under the title UV Waterworks, you can go to our website. We're at theconnection.org, and we'll have links there so you can find out more about the work that he's doing. Ashok, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the program today.
Thank you very much, Dick. It's a pleasure.
Ashok Gadgil, an environmental physicist, joining us there from a studio in California. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.